Okay, we are recording.
Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is my third and final series on the war in Vietnam, titled, A Letter is a Living Voice. We will be reading letters and documented accounts written by Vietnam veterans. These letters show all the emotion of war, from fear to anger to love and fellowship. These are only the opinions of the writers of the documents, and not those of the voice of Vashon or the readers. In addition, while some of the language in the documents may appear to be racially insensitive, it is the actual language of war. It is my opinion that to use the exact language to give the listener a true understanding of the veterans' ratings and their associated emotions is extremely important. In war, we demonize our enemy through our language and our pictures. We make them inanimate, therefore easier to kill.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. Wait a minute, please let the postman wait. Wait a minute, wait a minute.
Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series on letters from Vietnam. And today is a very special day because we have a, this is actually an account, I suppose, as opposed to being just a letter. But it's going to be read by Mike Dorsey. Mike Dorsey is a friend of the person who wrote the letter. And in this letter, it tells a little bit about someone who saved this person's life in Vietnam. And as a result of this, we are also going to follow up with VOV and through other channels and actually try and find this person who saved his life, Mike Morgan, and get him on Voice of Vashon on this series. So with that introduction, I'm going to let Mike take over here, and Mike will be on the mic, and so he's going to read this account. And Mike, tell me a little bit just first about kind of the relationship. You know this person because he was your neighbor here in Seattle, correct?
Yeah, his name is Bill Adamitis, and I met him when we both used to live over by in the Green Lake neighborhood in Seattle. We both had similar backgrounds. We were both Vietnam vets, and, you know, we got to know each other there and have remained friends ever since.
And now Bill has passed away now, and you have actually gone back to Thailand where he was living and have helped him, helped his daughter and him kind of get his things in order. And so you're very familiar with this situation. So without further ado, go ahead and start reading the letter and the documentation here, and then we'll talk a little bit afterwards.
Okay. All right. Good. Thanks, Steve. I'll just say a little more about Bill.
Sure.
One thing is, I consider this story to be sort of like the beginning of his PTSD. He had severe PTSD, was like 90% impacted, I guess is how they call it, and moved, wasn't making it too well in the U.S., and moved to Thailand maybe 25, 30 years ago. Bought a home and settled in and has been pretty much happy as a clam over there since then. Passed away just last year in August of a heart attack. And I found in his papers this story of his, the day he was actually wounded, and to me, kind of the PTSD day started. Mm-hmm. So,
He was in infantry?
Yeah, he was in infantry, 1968, way out in the mountains, out there, kind of the.
So a lot of action and a lot of things you don't see on the streets of Seattle, correct?
Hopefully not.
Well, not yet. Maybe we're getting there, right. but
let's hope not.
Yeah. Yes.
So this is a little bit. It's a number of pages here, so I better jump in on it here. So,
all right.
So here's Bill's story. It begins, that day, death walked with me up the hill and into the guns with every other American soldier walking behind me. Life as I knew it would end in the next 30 minutes, though I didn't know it then. May 16th, 1968, the Tet Offensive, the most massive North Vietnamese offensive of the entire war, taking full advantage of the traditional Vietnamese New Year, Tet, truce, caught completely off guard. More Americans were killed and wounded in 1968 than in any other year of the war. Suicidal in its intensity, the vicious North Vietnamese attacks marked the beginning of the end of the war in Vietnam, as the American people turned completely against the senseless loss of so many of their young men. The thinnest thread of luck nudged me from the list of the dead to that of the wounded. All major cities were hit hard. My battalion was deep in the mountain jungles of central Vietnam, between our base at Pleiku and the primitive mountain valley city of Con Tum, close to the Cambodian border. I had been in country for 6 months and had just turned 21 years old in the previous month of April. All of us expected to die, for to hold any hope at all would drive you insane with paranoia. I was lucky to be hit halfway through my one-year tour, because those who survived to live out the final days of their tour were insane with paranoia, as their short time remaining forced them to hope they might live. That's Bill. All right. I was part of a 400-man infantry battalion holding the top of a hill, scraped bald, with massive coils of barbed wire all around it and covered with log and sandbag bunkers. I was one of the four infantry companies that were usually out patrolling separately, 100 men per company. But we knew that there was a force of 400 North Vietnamese Army types in the area, also known as NVA. So all the companies were recalled to protect the firebase, where we had four large artillery guns to cover us when we were on patrol. On a smaller hill next to the firebase, we had set up a lookout post. Digging a trench around the top of the hill, we built four small bunkers at either end and at each midpoint of the oblong-shaped trench to hide in during artillery attacks. We kept 11 men up there 24 hours a day. We expected the NVA to attack our firebase, and we were ready for that. However, the night they came, they attacked the smaller hill. With 400 enemy soldiers all over that jungle-covered hill in the dark, in that pitch-black night, we could not move onto the hill to help those 11 men, although we were in radio contact with them. There was a young lieutenant in command there. We were all young. But as the enemy charged up the hill, firing heavily, the lieutenant immediately fell apart emotionally, becoming useless. My best friend, Mike Morgan, was up there at the time. He had a low rank because he was always breaking the rules, but he was an incredible fighter. And he took over command of the other 10 men. He was especially good at calling in artillery fire. This involves giving map coordinates to the artillery by radio. they fire their shells to hit and explode at approximately that spot. You can then instruct them to adjust their fire a number of yards in any direction. The NVA attacked at night so that we could not use our jets to drop bombs or our helicopter gunships to fire rockets. He could and did call in fire from larger guns further away. These guns could fire from 20 miles away and drop much larger shells to augment our own smaller artillery pieces. From the firebase, we could see nothing but explosions until we learned that they had a flamethrower, which became obvious when a blindingly bright funnel of flame appeared in the flat black field of darkness, which was all we could see. The funnel of flame was a horrifying thing to see and sent a chill up my spine. We learned later that Mike Morgan had moved into the open to get a good shot and had killed the guy with the flamethrower. Another NVA picked up the flamethrower, and we once again saw that huge funnel of flame. Mike Morgan again shot down that guy. And this time, he also destroyed the flamethrower. As the attack continued through the night, the men were slowly pushed back through the trench until all of them were crowded into the very last bunker. At that point, Mike Morgan called the artillery in on himself, saying in effect, "Fire at the spot I'm standing on," which means the shell are exploding all around you. If one lands directly on your bunker, everybody dies. He also requested that everyone at the firebase fire everything we had at the top of the hill. We had 400 machine guns, our large and smaller artillery, and a rocket launcher we had mounted on a Jeep. We fired for the rest of the night as fast as we could, empty and reloaded our guns. Of course, we knew the general spot our guys were all huddled together, and we didn't shoot in that direction. It was an exceptionally dangerous gamble Mike Morgan chose to take, and he fortunately won that wager of all their lives, which I did not learn until I found him later. Back at our firebase, we had lost radio contact and did not know whether they were still alive. Before dawn broke, we were all lining up in an attack formation, assuming there were still a lot of NVA up there. But everything had gone silent and remained so as we prepared ourselves. We lined up in a different order every time we moved, the point man walking first and the men immediately behind him are obviously in the most danger of losing their lives, so we took turns. The luck of the draw that day had my platoon further back in the line for this attack, and due to personnel shortages, I was assigned to carry the radio, which was very heavy and bulky in those days, and I hated to carry that monster. I was also extremely eager to get to the top of the hill with my arms free to fight. Saving my friend Mike Morgan was all I could think about. So I went to the front of the line and talked with the guy whose turn it was to walk first, the point man, and I offered to switch places with him. This was virtually the same as offering to die in his place, since the first guy up an enemy-held hill always died. He would carry the radio further back in line, and I would walk point. It sounds pretty stupid, and I'm sure the guy I replaced could not believe his incredible luck, but I was in a state of strong emotionalism, insanely obsessed to find my friend Mike Morgan and keep him alive, if he was still alive. During our ascent, I saw no one as I moved slowly and cautiously through the silent morning. When I reached the top, as I walked out of the jungle to the sunlit clearing of the camp, the first thing I saw was my friend Mike Morgan. He was standing there alone, shirtless, with no helmet on, and with a big grin on his face when he saw me. He was standing in the full sunshine, and his eyes were shining. He was happy to see me. But it was more like he was happy to have me with him for his little party, as if I was just stopping by for coffee on a beautiful morning in Southeast Asia. The guy was happy. He was a well-muscled guy. His back had thick ridges of muscle on either side of his spine. Carved into one of those cords of muscle was a perfectly formed groove in the shape of a bullet that would have passed directly over his spine. I had found him as soon as I crested the hill at the midpoint of the circling trench. I saw none of the other men, but Mike told me they were holed up in the end bunker and still alive. I saw no bodies on the top of the hill. The NVA it carried their dead away with them. He told me there were only two NVA left. They were in the middle bunker directly opposite from us, about 10 yards away. There were two trees between us that blocked our view of each other. He told me that in his first morning search of the area, he had been surprised to see one of the two remaining NVA wearing Mike's own helmet. This was especially funny because Mike Morgan's helmet had a peace sign drawn on its front. Mike was a very hairy hippie from San Francisco, one of the Flower Children movement, although obviously his position was as a rebel and not a peace lover. As the rest of our men moved up behind me, we discussed how to go about killing the last two NVA. One of our men carried a grenade launcher, which was like a short shotgun with a huge barrel. He suggested that he stand behind the tree that protected us from the straight-line rifle fire of the two NVA. He would swivel around the tree and fire a quick grenade shell into their bunker. He got into position, but immediately a shot was fired at him, slamming into the tree inches from his face. I cannot really describe the savageness of the noise that a high-power rifle bullet shot at very close range and slamming into a tree sounds like. Suffice it to say that our heroic volunteer's face turned as white as a sheet, and he moved back into our trench on wobbly legs, plan forgotten. I threw a hand grenade too far, and then Mike Morgan and I formulated the next plan. On the right side of the tree, I would crawl forward using a further tree as cover. This tree was 2 yards to the right of the first tree and 4 yards closer to the NVA, just out of line of sight of the NVA. Once in position, I would open up firing on full automatic as a machine gun to get their heads down, and Mike would pop up from the trench to the left of the closer tree and toss a hand grenade into their bunker. I pulled the trigger on my M16, and nothing happened. In the later stages of the war, it was discovered that the new M16 rifles, replacing the M14, were jamming, and that many dead Americans were being found holding rifles that had jammed. They were not working. It turned out this was due to the operating mechanism being so small and precise that when firing, the exploding bullets left behind a fine carbon dust that built up when the rifle was being fired. When very hot from heavy firing, the metal would expand, and then when the gun cools a bit, on top of all the carbon deposit, the mechanism freezes and will not operate the next time you pull the trigger. And this is what happened to my rifle after the last night of shooting all night long. So obviously, before the attack, I should have cleaned my rifle, but at the time, we did not know about the jamming problem, and we were all extremely preoccupied with the thought of walking into a major firefight. Ironically, the whole time I was in Vietnam, I cleaned my rifle constantly. So that day I walked up the hill in point position, finger on the trigger of a rifle that would not have fired. Parentheses, the high comedy of war, close parentheses. During the time we were planning our attack on the two NVA, they were throwing hand grenades at us. If they landed outside the trench, we would jump into the trench. If they landed in the trench, we would jump out of the trench, staying behind a tree. But they were mostly flying over our heads, as my hand grenade had gone over their heads. At the time I was pulling the trigger, they had lobbed a hand grenade gently, which landed right next to me. I had not heard it, and I did not know it was there. I heard confused shouting behind me, which I did not understand. Then I heard Mike Morgan's face in a loud, sharp, commanding tone. His voice literally grabbed me and threw me into instant action. I spun around and scrambled as fast as I could, diving into the trench. While I was in midair, with my legs still above the trench, the hand grenade exploded. This entire sequence of events occurred during a 1 or 2 second period of time. I landed in a heap. The grenade had exploded while I was in midair, upper body in the trench and legs still above ground level. As I picked myself up, the guy next to me told me I was bleeding. I didn't feel any pain just then, but I found the blood on my leg and began to notice a feeling in my legs like one feels when a leg or arm has fallen asleep and gone numb. As the feeling returns, there's a tingling sensation. This was a very intense tingling because it wasn't hurting and I did not see a lot of blood. I decided to ignore it for the moment. By this time, 6 months into my 1 year tour of Vietnam, I had begun to think I'd like to get a medal, hero style. I have always been achievement oriented, and I had read the testimonials that described what others had done to deserve a medal. Behind all the words of glorious heroism, I noticed that if a person had been wounded and then just continued fighting, they'd give you a medal. So when I was wounded, this thought popped into my head. I knelt up in the trench and got my rifle into position. I had evidently forgot that my rifle was not working. The sunny hilltop was now looking overly bright to me, strangely bright, and I began to feel an intense lethargy sleeping over me. I knew I was going into shock. I had thought that I could overcome shock with mental focus, but I could not stop myself from sinking down into the trench. The men to either side of me forced me to kneel up so that I would be ready for the next hand grenade. The next thing I remember, we were moving out of the trench back down the hill. By this time, I was feeling pain, and the intensity of the pain was increasing rapidly. I could no longer walk, and two guys were carrying me down the hill. They could not hold my legs up due to the pain that caused me, so they each had a shoulder under my arms with their arms around my back and lifting. My feet dragged just above the ground, occasionally snagging a vine, which sent streaks of pain shooting through my body. By that time, I was conscious of almost nothing but the pain. I do remember seeing the expressions of all the guys we passed on the way down, slightly awed and blank. It was the way I remembered feeling in past times as I watched dead or wounded men being carried past me. Then I was in a helicopter that brought me to a tent hospital, just like in the MASH series. There they cut off my boots and all my clothes to find all the wounds, some of which I didn't realize I had. From there on, it was on to another helicopter and to a normal type hospital and then into surgery. In World War II, they called my type of wound a million-dollar wound because it was severe enough to end the war for you without leaving you crippled. So I'd have to say that this was my lucky day, although I didn't feel lucky until they carried my stretcher down the ramp of the transport jet after landing at an Air Force base close to San Francisco. I had really never expected to see my home country again. 40 years after the war, as I considered how and why the war had changed my mental and emotional makeup so dramatically, I realized that the most significant change had most likely occurred in that last night and following morning. Up to that time, my single motivation was survival. I was your basic coward, as we all were, with the obvious exception of Mike Morgan. So it was totally out of character for me to go to so much trouble to put myself in the position of being the first guy to walk into the presumably waiting guns of the NBA with every one of the other 400 men behind me. I had to have been completely insane to do that. But something happened to my mind that night. I watched helplessly as my best friend fought for his life in a situation that was utterly hopeless. There was just no way that any of our guys were going to survive that attack. I had always been terrified of bullets, etc., in any contact with the enemy, but that morning all fear was gone, replaced with a calm, cold resolve. So it was not a big surprise that that was my last day of fighting. With that new attitude, I was not likely to remain alive and unwounded for much longer anyway. I may have been fearless, but I was not the super warrior that Mike Morgan was. He finished out his year in Vietnam, and we met up in San Francisco to laugh about the whole thing. In retrospect, I now feel that I had been forced into slavery by my own country, you might say. That is, the American government forced me virtually at gunpoint into its army to die in Southeast Asia. My option was to be imprisoned in a federal penitentiary or to go to Vietnam, the land of the free indeed. Over 1 5-year period of my life, 1963 to 1968, I went from a 17-year-old, shy, introverted, religious boy living in a boys' boarding school or seminary, in training to become a Catholic priest, situated in the middle of nowhere in the flat, hot Central California Valley, to being a 21-year-old combat leader, a sergeant, fighting in the mountain jungles of Vietnam, leading my men, whose lives I was in charge of, in gunfights with high-powered rifle machine guns against other men, with men dying on both sides regularly, until I was wounded by that hand grenade. Metal fragments of shrapnel hit my body, 3 in the left shin, 1 in the left thigh, and a very deep one in the right thigh, 2 inches from my reproductive handy pack. And then parentheses, a very close call, close parentheses. This would cost me 3 months of rehab before I could walk or move properly. So they carried me home to San Francisco on a stretcher. As I was carried down the transport plane's rear ramp and onto American soil, I really wanted to kiss the ground, but I was too overwhelmed with tears in my eyes to tell the guys to stop and put the stretcher down. Close parentheses. Also, this was not a very macho thing to do. Close parentheses. Most of the fragments are still in my legs, having ricocheted off the bones and gone deep into the tissues at different angles. The doctors did not want to cut new holes on me, and now they do not bother me at all. Souvenirs of my Vietnam holiday. And that
is the end.
The end of that.
Well, just to let people know, we will be looking for Mike Morgan, and we're going to use all our resources. If you, we're going to put this in several other forms in on Facebook and see if we can't find Mike Morgan. And if we do, we will be back with you, and you will hear all about it. Thanks, Mike, for doing that. Appreciate it. And we are out.
Listening to Is Abled with Dr. Stephen Nurse. This has been part three of his series on the war in Vietnam, entitled A Letter is a Living Voice. To hear additional episodes, including his previous series on the Vietnam War, go to voiceofashon.org and look for Is Abled under the Shows tab.